This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Brazil's president has COVID-19. Across the globe, a vaccine is seen as a way out of the pandemic, but it would only work if people were willing to take it.
There are two pandemics. One is biological, the second is social, and that's misinformation.
Mexico's president pays a visit to the White House. Most Mexicans think it's a bad idea, but it's a hard invitation to turn down.
There's always a concern that if you don't say yes to these kinds of invitations, you will be punished.
And Britain is clamping down on Moscow's inner circle.
Vladimir Putin personally hates my guts. I've been threatened with death, with kidnapping. They've gone to Interpol 8 times to have me arrested.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The coronavirus has infected yet another high-ranking politician. This time, it's Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, who has downplayed and even mocked the virus for months now. Reporter Michael Fox is in the Brazilian city of Florianópolis and reports that Bolsonaro revealed his diagnosis on television.
He was basically telling people that he's feeling good, he's feeling fine. Thank you to his supporters that were praying for him. And he was saying that even those who weren't praying for him, that's all right with them. And then he basically reiterated things that he's always said since the very beginning, that it's not that big of a deal. He's feeling okay. And for those people that are worried about it, even if they got it, the chances of it being very serious is next to nothing.
How surprising is this? I mean, did you expect Bolsonaro to reveal that he's tested positive for coronavirus?
Well, A, it's surprising that he's come down with it. It's kind of ironic. I didn't expect him to be revealing that. We saw something very similar that happened roughly 3 months ago when just after Bolsonaro and his whole team traveled to the United States to meet with Trump, roughly 24 of his top officials came down with the virus. They had contracted it in the U.S. And many people suspected that he had also gotten, in fact, there were reports saying that he had also come down with it. He did not release his test results at that point. So people weren't necessarily expecting that this time. At the same time, listen, he's been out in the streets with his supporters without a mask for months. So I think it's almost surprising for a lot of people that he hadn't got it already.
We've been covering Bolsonaro's failure to act urgently on COVID-19 for months. He famously has called it a little flu. How have his policies and attitudes on the coronavirus been changing recently, or have they?
Well, look, overall, he still says it's the same thing. You saw it in that clip earlier. This is not a big deal. Even if you got it, it wouldn't be that serious, so you don't have to worry about it. But there has been an interesting move. Just over the last week, he signed into effect a bill that had been passed by the Senate and the Congress mandating the use of masks across the country in public places. Now, he vetoed the section of it mandating it in places of worship, churches, businesses. But the fact that he took that measure to mandate it, at least, and sign that bill into law in public places is an important step, considering that he himself has been flaunting that very thing. In fact, there was a federal judge just a couple of weeks ago that mandated that he wear a mask in public when he's with his supporters.
Well, didn't Bolsonaro today say that he's been taking hydroxychloroquine and that made him feel confident that he would be fine?
Absolutely, he did. Yeah, that was one of the things that he made up front and center. He mentioned that he took it last night, he took it in the morning, and started feeling much better once he took it. So he's kind of using this moment as a pedestal to push his theories and his goals of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine. So yeah.
And we should mention that the WHO no longer recommends hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19, saying it has little to no reduction in the mortality of hospitalized COVID-19 patients. Final question, Michael. Did Bolsonaro say whether he's taking time off, stepping back to be treated, or is he just going to plow ahead and be president?
He's going to plow ahead and be president, but what he did say was he had canceled several trips and several meetings that he had for this week. He had there are at least three we know that he's canceled so far, and he ducked out of meetings earlier just yesterday. So he's still planning on being as active as possible. He's definitely not taking time and stepping back, at least in the near future. We'll see what happens in the coming days. Of course, it's coronavirus. We don't know how it's going to impact him as this week goes on. But until right now, he's pushing forward.
Reporter Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ever since the coronavirus first exploded across the planet, we've been told that we can take back control of our lives once we have a vaccine, the moment we're all waiting for. Well, maybe not everybody. According to a new survey in the UK, nearly 1 in 6 Brits say they'll refuse to take a coronavirus vaccine. Imran Ahmed is the chief executive of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate in London, a nonprofit that commissioned the survey. Imran, that's a staggering number of people who plan to avoid a vaccine. What were the reasons they gave?
Yes, we had 1 in 6 British people who said they definitely wouldn't or possibly wouldn't take a vaccine. We had another 1 in 6 who said that they were unsure. And so in total, 3 in 10 people were saying that they were vaccine hesitant. And we actually carried out the same survey in the US and found it was even higher there. So it was 4 in 10 in the United States. This was done by YouGov for us. And the reasons that people have are very varied, but what we know is that they've all swallowed misinformation of some kind.
So in your survey, did you ask people where they get their information so you could delineate, you know, are they getting it from social media? Are they getting it from traditional media outlets, that kind of thing?
That's exactly what we did, in fact. We looked at their media consumption, and that was actually the strongest correlation we could find to vaccine hesitancy was people who use social media to gain information more than traditional media were much more likely not to want to vaccinate. And what's been growing in a period in which most of us have been staying at home more than usual, we're exposed to a lot more misinformation online.
So are you saying that a lot of the misinformation comes from, you know, two friends in touch with each other and they say, oh, I saw an article here, read this, and it says, you know, XYZ. Is that the kind of thing? Or are you thinking intentional misinformation put out on social media?
Well, quite often when you do have peer-to-peer transmission, so one individual passing it on to another, the original sources are a small number of highly active, committed individuals who may be motivated because of ideology. They may be motivated because they are trying to make a buck out of it. And it's so sad to imagine, but in this crisis, a lot of hucksters, snake oil salesmen, have thought to themselves, well, you know what? This is a great opportunity for me to sell whatever crazy remedy I've come up with today. There are two pandemics occurring simultaneously. One is biological, and that's coronavirus. The second is social, and that's misinformation.
I'm curious, were you able to tell the basic demographics of the people who answered the survey?
We did. And I mean, in the United States, for example, we found that geographically it was pretty widespread. We did find a small age coefficient to misinformation so that older people were slightly more likely to believe it. But again, the strongest correlation we found was behavior. As we so often do with social phenomena, it's about attitudes and behaviors that we find the real differentiation.
What's your sense of why the anti-vaxxer movement has become so popular?
Well, I think that they've been very fast at exploiting this crisis, the coronavirus crisis. They have one job and they're very good at doing it, which is persuading people not to trust the science. And they'll use an opportunity like coronavirus in which, of course, there is a lot of uncertainty and people are scared. And so, of course, you've got these two factors, uncertainty and fear, which in combination are really good at driving conspiracy theory take up.
So next time I'm online and I see someone posting sort of an anti-vaccination piece about COVID, what should I do?
Well, first of all, social media platforms rely on one measure to decide whether or not to give something prominence, and that's engagement. So the first thing to do is to ignore the bad information, to block the person that's been sending it, and then to go and find some good information, something from the WHO or from a reputable health authority, and to spread that instead. It's actually only by outweighing the bad information with good information that we can have a healthier information ecosystem.
Imran Ahmed is the chief executive of the Center for Countering Digital Hate in London. It's a nonprofit that commissioned the survey. Thanks a lot, Imran.
Thank you.
Universities everywhere are still sorting out whether classes this fall will be held in person, online, or a mix. A lot of unknowns. What's clear, however, international students in the U.S. have to attend classes in person or they can't stay here. That's the word from U.S. immigration officials. If international students are taking their classes online, their visas won't be valid. That includes Noah Furlong Walker. He'll be a sophomore at Harvard University, and currently he's at home in Trinidad. Noah, what was your initial reaction when you heard this announcement from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, better known as ICE?
I was pretty upset about it because it kind of come at a worse time, to be honest. It came on the same day that our school announced that sophomores and juniors really would not be coming back for the entire of the next academic year. So it was a lot of news to take in on one day. And it just felt like the U.S. was making it particularly hard on international students, which they were. And so, yeah, just a lot of questions, wanting to know what would happen in certain scenarios, what's going to happen to certain people. So just a little bit of stress overall.
What have you heard from your friends and fellow international students, those going to Harvard or other places?
So right now, everyone, me included, are just in like a state of being very unsure of what's going to happen, because this is a pretty big ruling. This basically says that no international student at Harvard will be granted a visa or allowed to stay on campus. So like within our group chats and whatever, we're constantly talking to see what can be done. The Harvard International Office is currently, I think, doing as much as they can to get more information on this and also try to maybe amend it. I'm kind of lucky that I'm in a position where I don't really intend to go back to campus, just because Trinidad is doing pretty well with regards to coronavirus cases. I think it's safer for me here, but I do have other friends who are either on campus right now or intend to go back to campus. And now that's kind of just up in the air.
Now, for you, though, you are a sophomore, so technically Harvard won't let you in this year, but you can do it online.
Right.
But this announcement by ICE means that you might be in a position where you have to reapply for a visa.
Right. So my specific case is that I would prefer to stay here in Trinidad for the entire academic year. I don't think it has explicitly stated what happens in my case where if someone wants to stay away from their university, but I'm almost sure my visa would probably end up being void. I definitely see it going down that road of maybe having to reapply for a visa if this doesn't get changed.
Do you have friends at Harvard who are incoming freshmen or incoming seniors who are international students and are deciding whether to go back and be on campus?
I do have a couple international friends who are incoming seniors. And I'm pretty sure that they're in obviously like a little bit more stressful position than the average international student, because they're expected to go back. And now that might be a problem, even more so for those who are already on campus right now. And maybe their borders at home are closed. So they're just like, where do I go, really?
Do you have a message for your fellow international students affected by these new policy changes?
What I've been doing is trying to at least stay calm, trust in your university's administration to work things out to the best of their ability. I know Harvard has said that they're working with other universities right now to chart some kind of path forward as to how they're going to deal with this. And I think that is our best outcome, is that the universities are all advocating for us.
Noah Furlong Walker is an incoming sophomore at Harvard University. He's been speaking to us from his home in Trinidad. Thanks a lot, Noah.
No problem. Thank you so much.
So what's the role of universities in helping their international students figure this out? Larry Bacow is the president of Harvard, where Noah is a student. Bacow provided a statement to us that reads in part, we must do all that we can to ensure that our students can continue their studies without fear of being forced to leave the country midway through the year, disrupting their academic progress and undermining the commitments and sacrifices that many of them have made to advance their education. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The British government is laying down the law, blacklisting 47 people associated with human rights violations. The list includes 20 Saudis accused of involvement in the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Britain's Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said new travel bans and sanctions make it crystal clear to those who inflict unimaginable suffering.
We will not look the other way. You cannot set foot in this country. And we'll seize your blood-drenched, ill-gotten gains if you try.
Also on Britain's new blacklist, 25 Russians accused of aiding in the death of Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian lawyer who died while imprisoned in a Moscow jail on false charges. Bill Browder is a British-American financier who's been seeking justice for Magnitsky for years. I asked him what he thought about Britain's new sanctions.
My reaction was one of great joy. We've been working to get the British government to do this for 10 years. Britain is a place where the bad guys, the human rights violators and the kleptocrats, particularly like to buy mansions and send their kids to fancy boarding schools. It's a place that really matters. And for the British government to finally do this is a great milestone in our campaign.
Okay, so tell us specifically, what will these sanctions do and who will they affect?
So the Magnitsky Act does two things. It freezes the assets and it bans the visas of people involved in human rights violations and kleptocracy. And in our particular case, it applies to the people who killed my lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who was murdered in 2009 in police custody after uncovering a $230 million Russian corruption scheme. When people are added to this Magnitsky list, they effectively become what I would describe as non-people in the financial world. They can no longer open accounts. Their accounts get frozen, not just in the country that they're sanctioned, but just about everywhere, because all banks subscribe to these databases of sanctions lists. And so it's become a very powerful tool to even the balance between these dictators and the victims.
And this legislation in the UK, is it only to do with people directly or indirectly linked to the killing of Sergei Magnitsky, or is it a broad-based legislation applying to other human rights violations?
So this was inspired by the Magnitsky case, but it's now totally broad. It applies to human rights violators everywhere in the world. So, for example, the British didn't just sanction the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky. They sanctioned the people who killed Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist. They sanctioned the officials in Myanmar who were responsible for the Rohingya genocide, and they've sanctioned some North Korean entities that are responsible for slave labor in atrocious prison camps in North Korea.
Remind us, what is your connection to Russia, and how did you get to know Sergei Magnitsky?
So my connection to Russia is that I went to Russia after the fall of the Berlin Wall to set up an investment management business. It did really well for a long time until I started to complain publicly about corruption in Russian companies. I was then expelled from the country. My offices were raided. I hired Sergei Magnitsky to investigate why they were raiding the offices, the police. And he discovered they raided the offices in order to take the documents and use those documents in a $230 million tax rebate fraud of taxes that we had paid to the Russian government. Officials stole from the Russian government using documents seized by the police. He exposed that crime. In retaliation, he was arrested. He was tortured for 358 days, and he was murdered on November 16, 2009, at the age of 37. And so after his murder, it became my single and primary mission in life to go after the people who killed him and make sure they face justice. And that's what I've done for the last 10 years.
I know you met a few days ago with the UK's Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, along with Sergei Magnitsky's widow and son. What was that meeting like?
It was an extremely moving moment because we've all been working on this justice campaign, me and the Magnitsky family, for 10 years. And there we sat with the second most powerful person in the United Kingdom, and he was there to tell Sergei's widow and his son that Sergei's sacrifice wasn't in vain, that by his sacrifice, the UK government was going to use this law to go after other human rights abusers and Sergei's abusers, and that hopefully it will save lives in the future in Sergei's name.
In the case of Sergei Magnitsky, is it just the four people directly responsible for his death that you're after, or is there a kind of outer circle, an inner circle of people tied to his death that would be affected by this legislation?
As of right now, there are 25 people who have been sanctioned by the British government for perpetrating the human rights abuses against Sergei Magnitsky. However, there's another 25 or so individuals who were responsible for the corruption scheme that Sergei uncovered, that he was killed for exposing. They have not yet been sanctioned in the United Kingdom, although they have been sanctioned in the United States and Canada. And the Foreign Secretary promised us today that corruption will be added to the British Magnitsky Act in the fall. At that point, they can then sanction those individuals too.
Bill Browder, are you ever worried about your own safety? I mean, do you feel like the work you're doing is risky?
Vladimir Putin personally hates my guts. At the Helsinki summit with Donald Trump in 2018, when the U.S. asked for the 12 GRU officers to be handed over who hacked the election, Putin said, "I'll hand them over if you hand over Bill Browder and 11 Americans." They've been going after me in a big way ever since the Magnitsky Act was passed in the United States. I've been threatened with death, with kidnapping. They've gone to Interpol 8 times to have me arrested. They've issued extradition requests. They've done all sorts of crazy stuff. I'm definitely a high-value target for Vladimir Putin.
So what's next for you? What is your goal with the Magnitsky Act? I mean, let's say countries across the globe all adopt it. What do you ultimately want to achieve?
Well, countries across the globe have not yet all adopted. And the main geographic area that hasn't adopted it is the European Union. The European Union sort of prides itself on its humanity and its morality as an institution. But when it comes to this, they've been hamstrung by corruption within different member states who have been trying to block it. And so I have to get it done across the world. And the EU is my next most important target. And I don't think it's going to happen quickly or easily, but that's what we need to get done. Because even if you have this law in place in the United States and the UK and Canada, then the bad guys will just keep their money in France and Germany and the Netherlands. And so we have to close off all the comfortable places for them, all the places where they want to keep their money. So basically, if they commit their crimes in their countries, they have to keep their money in their countries, and they can't travel and spend their money in the West.
Bill Browder is a British-American financier. He's an outspoken critic of the Putin regime, and he's been seeking justice for his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, across the globe for years. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Start your morning with a quick hit of news from around the globe, stories that we're tracking. Our team here at The World will send it right to your inbox so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World. Just head to theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. In Iraq, people are grieving the assassination of one of the nation's top national security experts.
A relentless person who wanted to make sense of what is going on in his country.
Also ahead, there's a new record producer in town. The Dalai Lama drops his first studio album. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. This week was supposed to be a big one for President Trump, a chance to celebrate the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, one of the singular accomplishments of his administration, a chance for photo ops with the leaders of Canada and Mexico by his side in Washington. But Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is spoiling the party. Trudeau is raising concerns over potential U.S. aluminum tariffs and is staying in Ottawa. But Mexico's president will be in Washington. It's his first visit since taking office 19 months ago. And as the World's Jorge Valencia reports, the visit is generating some backlash back home in Mexico.
President Andrés Manuel López Obrador announced just a few weeks ago that he was going to visit Washington, and the response has been near unanimous.
Well, I think, I mean, the reaction has been pretty much, we all believe it's a bad idea.
Agustin Barrios Gomez is a former member of Mexico's Congress. He's also on the board of the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations.
We are the number one think tank on international issues in Mexico.
And as Barrios explains, this will be an unusual visit for President López Obrador, not only because he's going to Washington, but because he's traveling outside of Mexico altogether.
He is very domestic-focused. He has not left the country during his 2 years.
López Obrador says he's visiting to celebrate the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which went into effect on July 1st. This will be López Obrador's first diplomatic mission since he was elected in 2018. He was voted into office by a landslide.
Vengo a agradecerles.
Thousands cheered for López Obrador in Mexico City's main square the night he won. And since then, he has barely acknowledged President Trump's bashing of Mexico. Trump has said Mexico sends rapists and murderers and has threatened to force Mexico to pay for a wall along the border. Here's López Obrador in a press conference after his election.
Afortunadamente, ya no se habla mucho de ese tema. Yo no quiero hablar de
I don't want to talk about that, López Obrador says. That, by the way, is the border wall. And yet, many say that López Obrador has given in to most U.S. demands. Former Congressman Barrios Gomez points out that when U.S. officials told their Mexican counterparts last year to stop migrants from Central America, President López Obrador quickly sent his National Guard to Mexico's southern border.
So Mexico has actually deported more Central Americans than the United States has, and that is in keeping with a request from President Donald Trump.
Most Mexican political observers are criticizing the López Obrador-Trump summit because they see nothing good coming out of it. Even his most reliable proponents have struggled to find a silver lining. Here's historian Lorenzo Meyer in a political roundtable on Mexican radio.
A mí también me hubiera gustado que no fuera. Y yo estoy casi seguro que a...
I also wish he weren't going, Meyer says. For Amy Glover, a public policy consultant in Mexico City, she says she feels like she has to meditate before discussing the summit.
Exactly. This is a high-stress topic for me as a dual national.
Glover says she finds the visit problematic because she worries Trump will use the photo opportunity for political points in the November election.
And as a citizen of both countries, I don't think López Obrador should visit D.C., much less at this moment in time when there's a campaign going on.
Last week, members of the U.S. Congressional Hispanic Caucus sent a letter to Trump asking him to cancel the meeting. They say he's using it to distract from what they call his inadequate response to the pandemic. Glover sees the whole thing as a lose-lose for Mexico.
You know, Trump has repeatedly insulted Mexico and Mexicans, and the narrative from the Mexico side is this makes President López Obrador look very weak.
Plus, Glover says the renegotiated version of NAFTA doesn't give much to celebrate.
I don't see this as, wow, this is such a pro-market free trade agreement. It's a very managed trade type agreement. And in my humble opinion, it's a NAFTA minus.
Glover says she believes the meeting could be damaging for Mexico if Trump reiterates his so far inaccurate claims that Mexico will pay for the construction of a barrier between the two countries. And she says it'll be awkward for López Obrador with Democrats if, in November, Trump is voted out of office. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
The timing of the Trump-López Obrador summit looks awkward to many, including Roberta Jacobson. She served as the U.S. ambassador to Mexico from 2016 to 2018.
The president of Mexico could have come to the U.N. General Assembly and seen President Trump on the side, etc. Instead, he's waited 19 months in the middle of a pandemic and an economic crisis and 3.5 months before the U.S. election to choose to come to the United States, which seems particularly infelicitous.
Mexico's economy is plummeting. How worrying is that for both Mexico and the U.S.?
Well, it should be deeply worrying for both countries. But frankly, I think part of the point here is that you can understand economically why President López Obrador might want to come to the United States. He's bringing reportedly about 10 business people with him. The Mexican economy, you know, there's an old story about the U.S. catching a cold and Mexico getting pneumonia. This is a moment in which the three countries could be thinking about really relaunching North America, while many in the United States and elsewhere are talking about over-reliance on China. While there is a real movement to work to coordinate and deepen our economic recoveries, that doesn't seem to really be in the talking points of this visit. That may prove to be something could come out of this, which is a really important step for North America or bilateral integration. But I don't see that. I don't see the preparation having been done that would really help Mexico's economy.
Yeah, what I can't get my head around is the fact that López Obrador likes to see himself as a crusader for social justice, a man of the people. And his first trip overseas is to meet with Donald Trump. The optics look odd.
They do look odd indeed. And I have to say, they seem odd to many, many Mexicans as well. But I think the other thing you have to realize is while his social justice and man of the people persona are very much real and they are quite different than Donald Trump's, there are so many similarities that the two presidents share in their style, including an exaggerated sense of the ability of the executive to do everything, tendencies towards authoritarianism, that I think, strangely, they have found in each other a certain amount of compatibility on dismissing institutions and doing things themselves that you wouldn't normally expect. I recall the letter that López Obrador sent to President Trump when he, López Obrador, was elected, in which he said that the elite in each country, the political elite and the institutions, never expected them to win, but now they were going to be the ones carrying things forward. And I think that's a little bit the way they see themselves, alone in this fight, but continuing to amass power in their goals, even if those goals seem to differ.
The two men also seem to share similarities around how they're dealing with the coronavirus. What's a capsule summary of how López Obrador is dealing with it?
He dismissed it for way too long, right? He continued to encourage people to go to restaurants, to encourage them to hug, to have his meetings, his outdoor meetings and gatherings around the country for far too long. Even as he began to take it seriously, like President Trump, he has not worn a mask. It is a fundamentally anti-science perspective that he does share with President Trump. One of the documents that he put out in the last couple of weeks and comments that cabinet secretaries have made in his government have talked about, you know, the way those who are moral and poor will not get this disease, which was brought in by the rich, which is, of course, not true. So there is an anti-science sort of emotional bent and a polarization of this, that those complying with rules are sort of their enemies. They're the soft people or liberals. Interestingly, of course, as Mexico's numbers go up, the U.S. percentage and numbers are even higher. And what you see is northern Mexican states who are actually now considering and looking at ways to reduce the number of Americans coming into Mexico rather than the other way around because of the concern over the virus.
Roberta Jacobson served as the U.S. ambassador to Mexico from 2016 to 2018. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A prominent Iraqi analyst was gunned down near his home in Baghdad on Monday. Husham al-Hashimi was known for his research and writing about armed groups like the Islamic State. News of his death brought condolences from all over. Here's the world's Shireen Jafari.
CCTV footage appears to show exactly what happened to 47-year-old Husham al-Hashimi. Four men on motorcycles arrived at his house in darkness. When their target pulls up in his car, one of the gunmen approaches the vehicle and starts shooting. Then he runs back to the motorcycle and they all speed off. Those were the last moments of Hashimi's life. His death left Muhammad al-Wali in shock. He writes about Iraqi politics and lives in Baghdad.
Everyone is not believing actually the news. Especially that Husham al-Hashimi appeared on TV less than an hour before he got actually assassinated.
Wiley says Hashimi had deep knowledge about the Islamic State and other jihadi groups. He published several books and worked with research centers in the UK and the US. He was an informal advisor to the Iraqi government and made regular TV appearances. Here's Hashimi in a recent segment. Over time, he shifted his focus to speak about what he called unlimited power of Iranian-backed militia groups in Iraq. Iran founded and supported these militia groups to help defeat the Islamic State. But once ISIS lost ground, these militias remained. So far, no group has officially claimed responsibility for Hashemi's death. But shortly after the news broke, one of his friends posted online screenshots of WhatsApp messages that Hashemi had sent him recently. In them, Hashemi says he was threatened by the militias. Mohammed Al-Waili says Hashemi's assassination is a big setback for freedom of speech in Iraq.
I mean, he had said some of the things I didn't even agree with. But that's how freedom of speech is, right? You need people to say what they believe in without fear, and you need to have the space to debate, actually.
Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi came into office in May promising to rein in the militias, but that hasn't happened so far. Fanar Haddad, who writes about Iraqi politics, says Hashemi fell victim to the power struggle between Iraq's government and the militias.
What happened was a message to Iraq's prime minister and to his team and to his government. And in a way, it was very much, I think, related to and the response to the raid on Kataib Hezbollah last week.
In that raid, Iraqi government forces arrested members of Kataib Hezbollah, a militia group backed by Iran. Shortly after, supporters of the group stormed the highly secure Green Zone in Baghdad. They demanded the government release the men. Soon after, they were let go. Lahib Higel is with the International Crisis Group. She says the dynamics of these militia groups changed back in January when the U.S. targeted and killed two of their top leaders.
And all of this caused quite a lot of fragmentation and also disagreements among these groups on, you know, how to carry on with the resistance against what they call the U.S. occupation. And so Hashemi was seen as a part of this other camp.
Higel says she worked with Husham al-Hashemi for her research and will remember him as a kind, generous person.
It's a real tragedy for Iraqis, and I think it's very telling of who he was just by seeing so many of his colleagues and friends, you know, burst out in tears live on TV when they tried to commentate on his assassination.
Hashemi's body was transferred to the city of Najaf for burial this morning. Barham Saleh, the Iraqi president, condemned Hashemi's assassination on Twitter. He said the killers must be brought to justice. But Mohammed al-Waili in Baghdad is not holding his breath.
Many assassinations have happened in Iraq, and we never actually found out who this was.
Since the murder, Iraq's prime minister has fired one Baghdad police commander. That's probably not much of a consolation for Hashemi's family, who is mourning his death today. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The U.S. is trying to revive nuclear talks with North Korea. High-ranking American officials are meeting with South Korean and Japanese officials this week, but North Korea says it has no intention of coming back to the table. Jenny Town is the deputy director of 38 North, a website devoted to analysis of North Korea. She joins us from Washington. Jenny, first of all, why now? I mean, what's prompted the Trump administration's efforts to resume talks?
Well, I think the Trump administration has always been open to going back to talks. It's the North Koreans have been reluctant to come back to these working level meetings without some indication that there's an offer on the table and that is drastically different than what has been proposed in the past. I think the why now factor is really South Korea. President Moon has been pushing for this lately, especially after inter-Korean relations have really soured, after the demolition of the inter-Korean liaison office especially. And I think the South Koreans are really trying to rebuild some momentum. They hate to see what, you know, was once a promising situation lost basically overnight. And I think they feel like they're running out of options, right? They don't want to go back to the confrontational relationship that existed back in 2017. Unfortunately, I just don't think they're going to be successful in doing so.
Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un met three times before talks eventually stalled last year. Is North Korea unwilling to meet because they're expecting a similar result, or are they playing games?
I think they had high expectations, probably unrealistically high expectations of what could be done and how quickly something could get done by working with Trump. And I think a lot of that was fueled by the South Koreans kind of promising both sides greater influence than what they really had on either side. So when you go in with these sort of false expectations, I think the North Koreans were frustrated when there was reports of President Trump offering things, committing to things that were never delivered to the North Koreans. They have already lost confidence that South Korea can produce results without U.S. cooperation. And I think the U.S. position has not changed. I doubt it will change, especially before elections. I think this has really frustrated the North Koreans, and I don't think they see a way forward.
Obviously, a lot of global attention is focused on COVID-19 right now, and the whole North Korea drama has been pushed off the front pages. But has there been any significant moves in North Korea's nuclear program recently?
I wouldn't say there's been significant moves. Certainly during the negotiation process, they didn't simply stop producing anything. They have continued to advance their programs. They've maintained all of their major sites. So I think, the South Koreans now just are trying to prevent the situation from getting worse.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Stephen Biegun's in South Korea this week. What's that trip about?
There's some of it that's just maintaining diplomacy among the allies at this point in time. I think some of it is reassuring, especially South Korea in the wake of this antagonism. And I think there will be obviously some consultations on what to do next and what both sides are thinking about North Korea policy going forward.
Jenny Town is Deputy Director of 38 North, a website devoted to analysis of North Korea. Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks so much.
In many ways, Taiwan functions like an independent country. China is uncompromising, though. Beijing sees the island as a renegade province that one day must be returned to the Chinese motherland. But as the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, fewer and fewer Taiwanese people see themselves as Chinese.
The news in Taiwan is full of this sort of thing. Breathless coverage of Hong Kong, where a movement to keep the Chinese territory autonomous is struggling. There's also a fair amount of this news. Coverage of Chinese fighter jets buzzing near Taiwan. It's been happening a lot lately. Everyone knows China is way more powerful than Taiwan, which, despite having lots of U.S. weapons, is not much bigger than Hawaii. Taiwan's population is about 23 million, China's 1.4 billion. And this steady drumbeat of intimidating news about China's government is actually changing the way people in Taiwan talk about themselves. A new poll shows there's just been a big jump in people who say, please, just call me Taiwanese, not Chinese.
We don't want to be confused with Chinese together anymore.
That's Tsai Chia-hung from Chungchi University, which did the poll. Now, most people in Taiwan, their parents or grandparents fled from mainland China after 1949. That's when communists won the Civil War and founded the People's Republic of China. And everyone in Taiwan speaks Mandarin, the same language they speak in China. But Professor Tsai says most people in Taiwan are now so turned off by China's political system that they avoid calling themselves Chinese. Nearly 70% now just want to be called Taiwanese, full stop. That's a huge change from 10 years ago, when it was only 50%. And a generation ago, it was only 20%.
People in Taiwan feel like, oh, we are separate countries and we don't need to call ourselves Chinese anymore because Taiwanese can be a brand.
And that brand of an independent Taiwan is totally unacceptable to China. That's Wu Qian from China's defense ministry saying that if Taiwanese people pursue full independence, they will see their own, quote, self-destruction. Thing is, in Taiwan, the idea of total independence is getting more popular. Professor Tsai says people think, look, let's make it really clear who we are and not refer to ourselves as Chinese in any way. But not everyone thinks that way.
I will identify myself as Taiwan Chinese.
That's Tang Xiaocheng, a political scholar in Taiwan. And Taiwan Chinese, that's the second most popular identity label. And it used to be the main way people identified themselves in Taiwan. But it's going down. Only one in three prefer it now. But Professor Tang, He still likes it.
I will identify myself culturally as a Chinese. I eat with chopsticks and so on.
But politically speaking, Tang says, he is Taiwanese all the way.
So I have to separate the political and the cultural identity.
Put the two together, he says, you get Taiwanese Chinese.
There are lots of kinds of Chinese. There are mainland Chinese, there are Hong Kong Chinese, there are overseas Chinese, and there are also Taiwan Chinese.
Tang says American politics also plays a role here. The Trump White House has been more aggressive, giving Taiwan semi-official status. And Trump officials do like to portray China's government as a menacing empire, bearing down on Taiwan. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
The Chinese Communist Party is a Marxist-Leninist party focused on a struggle and international domination. We need only listen to the words of their leaders.
The U.S. really having Taiwan's back? Professor Tang says that makes Taiwanese people feel more bold, and that boldness affects how people speak. And that, he says, explains the new poll, which, by the way, also asked people, would you like to just be called Chinese, not Taiwanese? Less than 3% said yes to that. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
And we've got some new music to close out the show today, but not from anyone you'd likely expect. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
I have been to an 85-year-old's birthday party. There was cake and balloons, even a party hat. But there was not a new album. That is a new song from the Dalai Lama. He released an album this week called Inner World to celebrate his 85th birthday. The party was live-streamed on Facebook and included cameos from the likes of Richard Gere.
Happy birthday, Your Holiness.
Annie Lennox.
Happy birthday, Your Holiness. I would like to thank you for spreading the message of peace and compassion.
And Russell Brand, who couldn't help but throw in a joke.
I question the significance of a birthday for somebody who has been born many times. I mean, if you're reincarnated, what is a birthday?
The album's 11 tracks showcase His Holiness reciting mantras and giving short teachings, all woven to a bed of music. Here's another song called One of My Favorite Prayers.
For as long as space endures.
For as long as space endures, and or as long as living beings remain, the Dalai Lama says, until then, may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. New Zealand musician Janelle Coonan, a former student of the Dalai Lama's, is behind the project. She told a local radio show called 9 to Noon that she's been working on the album for 5 years.
I'm not sure we would have done this if we knew how long the journey would be and how difficult it would be.
Coonan said the Dalai Lama's gatekeepers originally nixed the idea. His involvement with music has been rare and never at this magnitude. But she tried her shot again a few months later with a note directly to His Holiness. That worked.
He actually was very, very excited about the idea, which really threw me in. If you can get to him, then the red tape goes away quite quickly.
The Dalai Lama visited Coonan in Auckland 3 times to record the tracks. Coonan says she also recorded some sessions at the Dalai Lama's residence in India. 30 instruments and 20 musicians later, Inner World is a new way, the Dalai Lama says, for him to reach people, as he explained in a video online.
I think I can say the very purpose of my life to serve as much as I can.
James Robson, a professor at Harvard's Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations, says he had mixed reactions to the album. He was surprised by it because music was originally prohibited in Buddhism.
But for other reasons, I wasn't entirely surprised, given that there's been quite a lot of use or interaction between Buddhism or other Asian religions and music, you know, going all the way back to the 1960s.
5 years ago, Janelle Coonan, the musician who spearheaded the album, could never have predicted the world we'd be living in now. The pandemic has led people to seek out new ways to find peace, which is one reason why a lot of those people, both Buddhists and not Buddhists, are tuning in to the Dalai Lama's new album. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Take a listen for yourself at theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow.
Oma Arabazan Hadi.